Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 2.3 million people are incarcerated in the United States, and a significant portion of those prisoners are held in private facilities owned and operated by for-profit companies. For-profit prisons hold more than half of the immigrants housed in federally funded U.S. detention centers. Here in California, more than 8,000 prisoners are currently held in out-of-state facilities owned and run by the private company Corrections Corporation of America. The CCA runs prisons with over 90,000 beds in 20 states. The corporation made $1.7 billion last year. And according to a piece in the Huffington Post called For-Profit Prisons Are Big Winners of California's Overcrowding Crisis, Governor Jerry Brown in October signed a three-year deal to lease the CCA prison at $28.5 million per year. Between 2008 and 2012, CCA's revenues in California more than doubled, even as the company's growth began to slow in other states throughout the country. According to Private Prisons, a report from the ACLU, over the past four decades, imprisonment in the United States has increased explosively, spurred by criminal laws that put more people in prison for longer sentences. At the same time, the nation has seen the rise in for-profit prison companies, which benefit from more people being locked up. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about this growing industry. How do private prisons differ from state and federal-run prisons? Have they delivered on their promises to provide the state with lower-cost prisons? And we'll also discuss the politics behind the contracts. Joining us today is Pat Beal. She's an award-winning investigative reporter with the Palm Beach Post, where she published an extensive series called Private Prisons, Profit, Politics, Pain. And Pat joins us from the studios of WPBI in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Chris Kirkham, a business reporter at the Huffington Post. He was a co-writer of the piece I mentioned about profitable prisons in California. Chris is a business reporter with the Huffington Post. He's been covering this industry since 2012. He's co-author of the many articles on prisons, and he joins us by phone from New York. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So why don't we start off by going over just the basics? There's been a lot of reporting about private prisons, but it's kind of difficult to just get some basic questions answered. First off, Pat, how big is this industry? I mean, how big are we talking about here?
Well, GEO Group and CCA are both multi-billion dollar corporations with revenues in excess of $1 billion each per year. In addition to the tens of thousands of individuals that they house in prisons, they are also the key players, as you referenced, in immigrant detention as well. So it's a huge business and definitely has been on the upswing.
And I should say we did invite the CCA and the GEO Group, but they did not return our calls. Do we know how many prisons they operate in the United States?
I don't know how many in the United States. We looked mostly at bed counts, and GEO and CCA both have between 70,000 and 90,000 beds.
And what is the main difference, Chris, between a privately run prison and a prison run by the state or the federal government?
So, I mean, the main difference is basically who is staffing them. So if you're, if you're looking at a state-run prison, I mean, a lot of times, traditionally states have had sort of prison guard unions. These are sort of better protected employees. They tend to stay there for a long time, whereas private prisons sort of grew up. A lot in the South. There's a lot of Southern states that were sort of more anti-union. The conservative cause has really embraced sort of privatization. And so in these cases, basically these are sort of at-will employees that work for the private prison companies. They tend to make significantly less money than some of the public prison guards do. And, you know, it's difficult to say specifically because there's not a lot of data out there, but sort of a lot of data has shown that turnover rates tend to be a lot higher at private prisons sort of for those reasons because of the compensation.
What can you tell us about the history of private prisons? According to the Corrections Project, one of the reasons why we have these is because in the mid-1980s, 15 years of massive and unprecedented growth within the prison system hit a snag, and it basically ran out of money. So states would go to the voters and say, hey, we need money to build a prison. And the people would say, no, we should use this money for other things. And then the private prison industry came knocking and said, well, if you don't have the money, we can build them. So can you give us a little historical perspective here?
I think you have to go back.
Oh,
yeah.
Go ahead, Pat.
You know, starting in the mid-1990s, there was a tremendous push to stiffen sentences across the country that was being promoted by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which for your readers who may not be, or your listeners who may not be familiar with ALEC, is a group of state lawmakers and big business interests that create model legislation and take it back to state legislatures. Florida was especially receptive. We were in the middle of a massive crime wave, and so the private prison industry directly benefited from these very stiff sentences. And about the time that Florida was adopting the stiff sentences, private prison construction here just took off.
And what would you add to that, Chris?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, basically, I think one of the issues also was that, typically states, they had to do general revenue bonds in order to sort of build new prison facilities, and private prisons sort of were able to come and say, hey, we're sort of operating outside of that process. We can build this right now, and you can sort of give an outlay to us. And so it's different in that, like, the state doesn't necessarily own the facility, so the private prison could build it quicker. And in a lot of cases, I mean, it was definitely overcrowding, and, there were definitely stiffer sentences. The number of prisoners coming into the system, basically the capacity of the system could not keep pace with that. And so private prisons were there to sort of take on that overflow.
And according to the ACLU, the number of inmates in private prisons has increased by 1,600% since 1990. And Pat, as you mentioned, the CCA and the GEO Group, the two largest private prison companies alone, took in $3 billion in revenue. Their top executives each received annual compensation packages worth well over $3 million. When you follow the money, who's investing in these prisons, Pat?
Well, lucky shareholders. If you were holding CCA or GEO stock a couple of years ago, you might have paid, I don't know, less than $10, $3 even, I think, in one case. And now they're trading in the $30 range. They are Wall Street darlings. Even Florida's pension system has invested in both GEO and CCA from time to time. So you have, you have major institutional investors looking at these two companies and saying, it's a good deal for us.
Right. And Salon has a piece about Wells Fargo, the GEO Group's second largest investor, holding about 4 million shares valued at more than $72 million. Chris, what would you add to that when you follow the money?
Yeah, I mean, these are major banks, major pension funds. Basically, I think if you look at your 401k, I'm pretty sure most of the major Fidelity, Vanguard have got big time investments in these, and sometimes those aren't necessarily active investments, but your portfolio sort of is going to include a wide range of different types of investments. And I think what has been interesting in the past few years is that there has been some more sort of activism on this front in terms of socially responsible investing and whether sort of private prison investments make sense. And the United Methodist Church actually made a really big push in 2012 to divest their church investments. They have a wide portfolio. They made a big deal of pulling out of GEO Group and CCA investments because they didn't feel that this was something that their church should support. So it's been interesting in that way. I mean, there's been a lot of immigrant rights groups have pushed. They pushed Wells Fargo, and I believe Wells Fargo last year reduced their investment in the GEO Group. So it's not quite as they're not quite as big of an institutional investor as they were. But yeah, I mean, this is sort of all the major major banks, major pension funds are sort of deeply invested in these guys.
And Pat, how does a prisoner get sent to a private prison? Who makes that decision?
Well, in Florida, the Department of Corrections makes the decision to send the prisoner to the private prison, and from there it starts to get pretty tricky. Private prisoners in Florida or prisoners in private facilities in Florida tend to be the healthiest, have the fewest mental illnesses or least severe mental illnesses, and also seem to be the least troublesome. And part of that is because it's written into the contracts with the private prisons. And so you have situations like Blackwater River Prison, which was built expressly to hold large numbers of seriously mentally ill individuals, and by contract holds none at this point. I think maybe 20 or 30 of that.
So if they're contracted to hold people with mental illnesses, I mean, that requires a lot of staff and a lot of special attention. Based on your research, does the private prison, would they do more for people that have mental illnesses versus a state-run prison, for example?
Well, they have, you know, they have very few people who would be, who are classified as what's known as S3, which would be prisoners who are in need of routine psychiatric as opposed to psychological care, and typically need medication, and the psychotropic medications are a huge cost in the prison system. So I'm not so sure it's an issue of whether they would do more or less for their prisoners with mental illnesses. They just don't have a lot of prisoners with mental illnesses to do anything with.
So is there any oversight?
Oversight in Florida is bifurcated. We are the only state in the union where our oversight is split between the Department of Management Services, which oversees contracts and contract violations, and the Department of Corrections. And authority was specifically taken away from the Department of Corrections because there was a feeling among politicians that correctional officials in Florida would simply be least likely to be helpful to private prison interests.
That is Pat Beal. She's an award-winning investigative reporter with the Palm Beach Post, where she published an extensive series called Private Prisons, Profit, Politics, Pain. We're also joined by Chris Kirkham, a reporter with the Huffington Post. He's co-author of the piece For-Profit Prisons Are Big Winners of California's Overcrowding Crisis. And now I would like to welcome Alex Friedman to the show. Alex is managing editor of Prison Legal News, a monthly publication that reports on criminal justice issues. Alex spent 10 years behind bars in the 1990s, including six at a privately operated facility. He is a shareholder in the CCA. In 2012, he proposed a resolution to get them to submit two reports a year about rape and sexual abuse in their facilities. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you. So you've got firsthand experience in all of this. I mean, what would you like us to know about the differences between these for-profit private prisons and state-run facilities?
Well, having an empirical perspective does lend a different thought on prison privatization. Unless you actually have been in a prison, it's kind of hard to understand what it's about and what some of the differences may be. But primarily, all prisons have a lot of similarities because they have many of the same requirements. They have fences, they have officers, they have medical services, they have chow halls and so on, whether public or private. The main difference with private facilities is a greater emphasis on cost cutting, because unlike their public counterparts, private prisons have to generate profit. That's the reason they exist. They exist for no other reason, like any other private company, Walmart, Target, Burger King, and so on. They have to generate money for their shareholders. So at the facility that I was at, the South Central Correctional Facility in Tennessee, which is a state prison that was run by Corrections Corporation of America, the emphasis on cost-cutting manifested itself in things like a poor quality food. They would give out fewer blankets. They would ration toilet paper. They would also have inmates do security-oriented tasks that would probably have been better done by correction staff, things like stringing razor wire on the fences, or in one case, for example, we created a program in our desktop publishing lab to track the failures of the perimeter fence alarms. In other words, security-type things that you generally don't want prisoners doing, But since it's basically free labor, it's a great way for the companies to cut costs if they have inmates do that kind of work. One thing I specifically noticed is the difference in staffing. So I served time both at a privately operated prison and a very comparable state facility. And after being transferred to the state facility, it was very noticeable that there were many more staff members on the compound, many more officers. Mm. And what that means is that if something bad happens, if there's a fight or a riot or something breaks out, then you have more staff to respond and adequately deal with that situation. As Chris mentioned, in private prisons, they tend to understaff. They have fewer staff and much higher staff turnover, in large part due to the lower wages that they pay. So those are some of the differences between public and private.
And just quickly, Pat, because we're going to go to Jeffrey Callison with the Corrections Department in California in just a minute, but can you quickly talk about how understaffing in private prisons affects the prisoners and just, you know, what actually goes on behind bars?
Absolutely. We looked at CCA and GEO, compared it to the Florida Department of Corrections over the last 10 years. What we found in the private prisons were 10 major riots since 2000, 3 Justice Department investigations. Discoveries of squalor and sex abuse prompted 3 states to remove teenagers from juvenile facilities. A state removed female prisoners. At one facility where even the chaplain was involved in assaults at Florida state-run prisons, the same 13-year period, no major damage or severe injuries from riots, no closures over squalor, no Justice Department investigations over human rights violations, and in almost every case that we looked at where there were problems, staffing was clearly an issue. Too few guards, too many inexperienced guards, and in some cases, guards who were simply unsuited for this particular type of business.
And again, that's Pat Beal. She published an extensive series for the Palm Beach Post called Private Prisons, Profit Politics, and Pain. And now I would like to welcome Jeffrey Callison to the show. Jeffrey is a spokesperson for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and he can stay with us until the break. Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Nice to have you. So how many private prisons are in California?
Well, I can't really speak for how many private prisons there are. Those are private entities, and I work for the State Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. But the two private companies that we have contracts with are two that have been mentioned already in your program, Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group.
Okay, and so can you talk about when did the state first sign contracts with these corporations?
Well, in-state contract beds we've been using for quite some time, albeit not necessarily in very large numbers. As regards to out-of-state beds, which accounts for the vast majority, just so you have some context here, as of December 4th, we had 8,673 inmates in 4 out-of-state prisons. That's out of a total custody population of about 133,000. We sent inmates out of state in 2006, which, as some people will know, was the peak of the prison overcrowding crisis in California. And the governor at that time, Governor Schwarzenegger, in response to the fact that the prisons were at that time at 200% of design capacity, signed an executive order to allow for sending some inmates to out-of-state prisons. It was not intended to be a long-term solution, but it was a necessary solution at that time just to deal with what was, without doubt, a crisis.
And in October, Governor Brown signed a 3-year deal to lease the CCA prisons at $28.5 million per year. And Chris Kirkham, one of our guests, reports for the Huffington Post, and he reports that between 2008 and 2012, CCA's revenues in California more than doubled, even as the growth is slowing in other states. So why is this happening? I mean, why is California deciding to sign these massive deals with these private prisons?
Well, I don't know if they're massive deals, but and I certainly can't comment on whether or not it's good for business for CCA. That's entirely a matter for them and their shareholders. And just it's important to note here, the contract you just referred to is for an in-state facility inside California. The prisons we've been talking about are in out-of-state. The California City facility, the one that you're referring to, is one that we will be leasing for a period of a few years, hopefully just a period of a few years, starting fairly soon. And that is a CCA facility, although it's going to be staffed solely with CDCR staff. We're currently training staff for that facility. Generally speaking, why do we have these contracts? Well, quite frankly, if it was entirely up to the state of California, we'd have no contracts with private facilities. We don't want to be contracting with private facilities. The out-of-state contracts that were signed under executive order in 2006 was a response to the overcrowding crisis. Now, in 2012, we published basically a master plan for the corrections department for the next 5 years. And a key part of that was winding down the out-of-state program so that by 2016, we would have no prisoners in out-of-state facilities. However, the ongoing federal court lawsuit over prison crowding has essentially suspended that for now. Governor Brown wanted to end all of those contracts, but that's just not practical at this point.
And let me ask you this. I guess I say massive because as we're seeing major budget cuts in this state affecting everything from, you know, education to in-home supportive services, California is now CCA's second biggest customer, providing $214 million to the company last year. And I wonder what you think about what CCA said in its SEC filing. Quote, the demand for our facilities and services could be adversely affected by leniency in conviction or parole standards and sentencing practices. These corporations basically admit that obviously the more people in prison, the more money they make. So what are your thoughts on that?
My thought about that is that's entirely their business, whether or not it's good for their business or not. My point is that the state of California would ideally not have any contracts with private facilities, whether in the state of California or outside the state of California. The state has essentially at this point no option but to continue those contracts.
So can you tell us about some of the terms of the contracts? Because the SACB reported that the governor is hoping rehabilitation efforts will allow them to avoid using private prisons.
Absolutely. There was a bill passed in the legislature, SB 105, essentially a bipartisan bill that was intended to be a response, a solution to the federal prison crowding case, and Governor Brown happily signed that bill. And it allowed us to comply with the federal court order by temporarily leasing private beds while longer-term criminal justice reforms can take effect, focusing on improving recidivism rates, increased rehabilitation, and so on. We're still waiting to find out whether or not the federal court will allow that to happen. And in the meantime, we're basically waiting for an order. But in our mind, the best solution is to have all of the prisoners under the supervision of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to be in state facilities inside the state of California.
Because as it stands right now, we've got 8,000 inmates in Arizona, Mississippi, and Oklahoma.
Yes.
And just quickly, we're going to go to break. Are you concerned about what we heard earlier, that there's so much understaffing and it leads to a lot of problems for the prisoners and just, you know, the prison in general and these private prisons?
Well, you've been talking about experiences in other states. I can't talk about staffing levels that other states have with their systems. A private facility outside the state of California is run somewhat differently than a prison inside the state of California, and that is in large part because the inmates who are sent to the facility, certainly under contract with the state of California, with our out-of-state contracts, those are inmates who, for example, no level 4 maximum security inmates, no life sentence inmates, no validated gang members sent there, no one with serious medical conditions. Those are the kinds of conditions that our contracts operate under. So naturally, they don't require typically the same kind of supervision.
Jeffrey, can you stay with us for just a few more minutes?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Today we're talking about private prisons. We'll be back after this.
KALW, if you have a perspective that you have not yet heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join us. Get in touch by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question on the website, yourcallradio.org. And don't forget, coming up at 11 from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. You're on local public radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss media coverage of the parliamentary trial of Guardian editor-in-chief Alan Rusbridger. He's accused of helping terrorists by publicizing top-secret information leaked by Edward Snowden. We'll also discuss media coverage of Syria. The UN has accused President Bashar al-Assad of committing war crimes for the very first time. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the growing private prison industry. In 2010, the two largest private prison companies, the CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, and the GEO Group, took in $3 billion in revenue. According to CNBC, their top executives each received compensation packages worth well over $3 million. We invited both of them on, and they didn't return our calls. Today, we're joined by Pat Beal. She published an extensive series called Private Prisons, Profit, Politics, Pain for the Palm Beach Post. Chris Kirkham is a reporter with the Huffington Post, where he covers these issues. He recently took a look at what's happening in California. And Alex Friedman is managing editor of Prison Legal News. He spent 10 years behind bars in the 90s, including six at a privately operated facility. And joining us for just a couple more minutes is Jeffrey Callison. He's spokesperson for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I know we have to let you go, Jeffrey, soon, but I just wanted to find out, I mean, when you think about, you know, people being kind of shuffled around, I mean, it's hard enough for families to visit inmates when they're 5 hours away in the Central Valley. I mean, they can't visit them, I'm sure, in Mississippi, because a lot of these prisoners come from low-income communities. So who decides whether to place a prisoner in a state-run facility or a private prison?
Well, we agree with what you described there about one of the challenges about having an inmate in an out-of-state prison. And that's just one of the reasons why we would prefer to have no contracts with out-of-state prisons involving out-of-state prisons. But the reality is right now we have those contracts. We'd like to end them, but we can't for now because of the federal court proceedings. In terms of who gets sent out of state, it's really as much a matter of who can't be sent out. And a couple of minutes ago, I told you the kind of prisoners who can't be sent out, the type who require more security, the type who require more medical care. Of course, that leaves a lot of prisoners who can be sent out of state. And even if you're within the state of California, any prisoner within certain parameters can be sent to another prison depending on the needs of the prison system. And California is a big state, so in some cases you could be 500 miles away from your home,
right,
even inside the state of California. We know that it's the one thing that helps rehabilitation is to keep prisoners as close as possible to their family and friends. And so when you're in the state of California, that helps. If you're not in the state of California, that doesn't help. That's why we'd rather not have those out-of-state prison contracts.
And what is can you just give us insight about what's happening behind the scenes? I mean, California gets a lot of media attention because California leads the U.S. in incarcerating drug offenders, for example. 9,000 offenders are serving life in prison, including many third strikers. What's being done to ensure that this doesn't just continue to go up, especially for people in for nonviolent offenses and, you know, marijuana possession, for example?
Well, I can't vouch for the accuracy of what you just said. I'm not going to dispute it, but I can't agree with it either. Realignment, AB 109, was an important step in that direction because AB 109 was essentially a sentencing reform, which meant that starting October 1st, 2011, people convicted of a non-serious, non-violent, or non-sex offense felony would be sent to county jail or some other form of county supervision instead of being sent to the state prison. Because it used to be that some people would be convicted of nonviolent, non-serious crimes, given a sentence of 3 months, sent to prison. There wasn't even enough time for them to complete their entry into the state prison system, and they'd be released. Well, that kind of ridiculous churn was one of the reasons why we had a prison crowding problem in the state of California, which is why a realignment was needed. So that's one step along that direction. SB 105, the bill that we talked about earlier that the governor has signed, part of that involves extensive discussions among various stakeholders to figure out long-term solutions to so that California does not go back to the terrible crowding levels of the past. That process is excuse me, that process is still underway, and it does involve the legislature, so I can't comment on that.
Okay, and I got those numbers from the New York Times. They had a piece called California's Continuing Prison Crisis. And let's take a quick caller, and then we'll let you go, Jeffrey. Thanks for staying so long. Let's hear from Emily Harris from Californians United for a Responsible Budget. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. Well, I have just a quick comment in response to what Jeffrey was saying earlier, which was about whether or not California has a choice to send people out of state. And it's really clear that Californians want the state to reduce the number of people that we lock up. And so we could be responding immediately by reducing the population of, you know, medically fragile prisoners, people who are elderly, people who are in for nonviolent drug offenses, and could be meeting the court order immediately. And so my question is, isn't sending people out of state just a stopgap for California as we are sort of behind the scenes building thousands of new prison beds in San Diego area and in Ione, California, so that we can just bring those prisoners back in a few years once we have more capacity in California?
All right. Thank you for calling in, Emily.
Well, I wouldn't call it a stopgap, but it was certainly intended to be a temporary measure to the extent that the state planned to end those contracts by 2016, but we can't do that right now. As regards to these thousands of prison beds that Emily is referring to, it is correct that we plan to build about 2,500 prison beds, but there's a very important but that she didn't get to there, and that is that the other half of that plan was the shutting down of an old prison in Norco that had about the same number of beds. So the construction of these new, more modern prison facilities that will be built inside existing prisons were entirely to offset the closure of an antiquated prison that really doesn't meet modern standards. Now, it is worth noting that because of the federal prison crowding case, that the plan to close Norco, the prison in Norco, is suspended until this prison case is resolved. But as far as the state of California is concerned, I can absolutely assure you the plan is to close Norco and offset that with a similar number of beds built in San Diego and Ione, or thereabouts.
All right. Well, Jeffrey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jeffrey Callison is spokesperson with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, talking to us about the new contracts between the state of California and the CCA and the GEO Group, two of the largest private prisons, bringing in $3 billion in revenue yearly, and their top executives receiving compensation worth well over $3 million. And again, we did reach out to the CCA and the GEO Group, but they did not return our phone calls. And today we are talking about the growing private prison industry. And what questions do you have about these facilities? And what are your thoughts about Governor Jerry Brown's plan to sign contracts with these private prisons? If you've been in a private prison or if you have any experience working with one, we'd love to hear from you. If you live near one, what differences do you see? And what are your thoughts about states really embracing the privatization of prisons? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We are joined today by Chris Kirkham, business reporter with the Huffington Post. He's co-author of the piece, For-Profit Prisons Are Big Winners of California's Overcrowding Crisis. Pat Beal is an award-winning investigative reporter. Her extensive series, Private Prisons, Profit, Politics, Pain, ran in the Palm Beach Post. And Alex Friedman is managing editor of Prison Legal News. He spent 10 years behind bars in the 1990s, including six at a privately operated facility. And let's hear from Danielle Rigby, calling in from Auburn, whose son was sent to a private prison in Arizona in July. Hi, Danielle. Thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. So tell us about your son.
My son was moved. He was in California for about 2 years, and then he went in front of committee, and they told him that he was on the list to go to Arizona, and where he said he did not want to leave his family. While he was in California, even though we had to travel 4 hours to see him, we visited him every single weekend. One day we went to go visit him, and he was gone. He didn't even have time to call us. We drove the 4 hours, and he was already gone. He was in Arizona. Now he's about 15 hours away from us. He's been there since July. Mm. His father hasn't been able to see him. His grandfather's too elderly to visit him. And I am his mom, and I've only seen him 3 times since he's moved.
Wow. How old is he?
He was 19. Now he's 22.
Wow.
We have 3 more years to go.
Have you asked him about the differences between what it was like being in prison in California and what it's like in Arizona?
Well, I think it's important. Well, let me answer that first. Okay, there's different things. Instead of being in a dorm, he's in a room. Visiting is not as good because we can't touch each other. He can't get up unless he raises his hand. You know, there's things like that. But more importantly, he's away from his family. When he was getting visits every single weekend, now he's gotten visits every 6 weeks, if that. And even Jeffrey from the CDCR, he even acknowledged that the state believes that the most important thing for rehabilitation of these prisoners is to allow the family support via visitation. Right. And they've completely taken that away from us.
Right. Well, so because
we're getting financially destroyed because we want to visit our son.
And you have to fly to Arizona to do it.
Yeah, and the cheapest ticket from Sacramento is $350 round trip. The very cheapest. That doesn't include me taking his three sisters or hotel or rent a car.
And Danielle, because you have personal experience with this, what are your thoughts about the private prison industry and how California is dealing with this?
Well, I think that it's really sad that they're taking these people, because when we used to visit him in San Quentin and Jamestown and other prisons in California, the visiting room would be full of children, mothers, wives visiting their loved ones. And now, with there's over 3,000 prisoners in La Palma where he's at, we at the most have seen 10 people getting visits. And he's told me personally that they're, almost everybody around him is very sad and very upset and very isolated because they haven't seen their children, their loved ones.
Mm. Well, thank you for calling in, Danielle.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for having this forum.
Thank you so much. That's Danielle. Her son was sent to a private prison in Arizona from California. And Alex, I'm sure this is a common story, right?
It is, and it really kind of exemplifies one aspect of the private prison industry that a lot of people kind of aren't familiar with, and it is that these out-of-state contracts. California is only one of four states in the nation that house its state prisoners in out-of-state contract private facilities, and the others are Hawaii, Vermont, and Idaho. And a lot of people might think, you know, when they hear about issues like this, well, these prisoners committed crimes, so who really cares? They get what they deserve, and so on. But the impact is equally on prisoners' families who have not committed crimes and who are significantly impacted by these transfers when their loved ones are sent, you know, thousands of miles away in some cases, and they can't visit them. And if they want to stay in touch by phone, then they have to pay the most expensive phone rates, which are exorbitant, you know, long-distance rates that range up to more than $17 for a 15-minute call in some facilities. Mm-hmm. So the hardship is not just on prisoners, but it's definitely on their family members. And beyond that, also on our communities, because studies have repeatedly shown that prisoners who stay in close communication, close contact with their families while they're incarcerated have better outcomes after their release and are less likely to commit additional crimes and go back to prison. So this family communication and family contact is very important in reducing recidivism, and that is sacrificed in large part when prisoners are sent to these out-of-state private prisons.
Hmm. Can you tell us more about the resolution you filed with the CCA in 2012 to get them to submit 2 reports a year about rape and sexual abuse in their facilities?
Absolutely. So I am a shareholder in CCA and GEO Group. I own a small amount of stock, so I can engage in shareholder activism to bring issues to the attention of the company and the shareholders. And the resolution you're referring to was to require CCA to issue biannual reports on basically what it's doing to reduce incidents of rape and sexual abuse at their facilities. And as the other speakers mentioned, you know, the industry has a really bad track record in terms of rape and sexual abuse. And in Kentucky, the one example that was mentioned, both Hawaii and Kentucky removed their state prisoners from the CCA-operated Otter Creek Correctional Facility, largely due to rampant sexual abuse by CCA employees, including the chaplain. And first time that I'm ever aware that any state has removed its prisoners from a facility due to sexual abuse by private prison guards. So the resolution was to try to gain some traction on that issue to bring it to the attention of shareholders in the company and to try to get reporting on what the company is doing to reduce those incidents.
And Pat, one of your pieces is Parade of Horribles in Privatized Prisons, and you take a look at exactly what Alex is describing. This is kind of a strange question, but is this any different from state and federal-run prisons when you're talking about sexual abuse and rape?
Well, actually, that's a great question, and we put a lot of thought into it. And actually, it was Alex who told me very early on, you know, prisons are bad places, and people sometimes do bad things in those prisons, whether they're public or private. But as an ACLU attorney said, we do see the same types of problems in public prisons as we see in private prisons when they are understaffed and underfunded. And that's really key because, as Alex pointed out, these companies have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders. Fiduciary duty means they have to make money. And one of the easiest ways and fastest ways to make money is to have guards who are either offered fewer benefits, less money, or in some cases, less training. We found a young guard at the Hernando County Jail in Florida, which CCA was running at the time. He started when he was 19 years old. His previous experience was Chick-fil-A. And although I have nothing against Chick-fil-A, he was also earning as he learned because he was not a certified guard. In fact, a huge percentage of the corrections officers that facility were not certified. They were taking training and certification at the same time they were working on the floor of this jail.
Wow. And do these prisoners have a way to report abuse? And what are the differences between reporting abuse in a private prison and a state-run prison?
Well, you know, in both cases, there is a there are a multitude of forms that have to be filed. One of the interesting things that we found when we were looking at lawsuits filed by inmates in private prisons was the number of times that paperwork that was necessary to be filed before a federal action could be continued disappeared. It wasn't fully filled out. It was partly filled out. Or in some cases, inmates felt that they would face retribution if they filled it out, and they were trying to get into federal court to get assistance.
And Chris, we've got an email from Glenn who wanted us to talk about the prison industry spending a lot of money on Democrats and Republicans' campaigns. He says to ignore this is not to have an honest dialogue. If you voted for a Democrat or a Republican in the past couple of decades, you support the prison industry. Pardon all nonviolent drug offenders today and then see how the overcrowding issue looks. And you point out in your piece that the CCA spent about almost $300,000 on California campaigns during the 2011-2012 election cycle. That's up more than eightfold from the 2005-06 cycle. And Jerry Brown has taken in $15,000 from the CCA, which also spent $50,000 in support of his initiative to raise taxes. He received almost $30,000 from the GEO group. So how much influence do these prisons have on politicians, and how has it changed over the years?
I think this is definitely the state of play in sort of any state where private prison corporations seek to do business. I mean, I think the argument that they make is that typically, they're just trying to sort of buttress the same amount of political power that a prison guards union has. In California, prison guards union is a very, very powerful group and has been historically. And actually worked very hard to sort of keep private prisons out of California for many years. But I think certainly you see whenever you see new business opportunities, like if a state is considering new procurement for contracts, you'll see CCA and GEO Group really, really step up the lobbying. And this is certainly becoming more true in California, but I think in states like Arizona and definitely states like Florida, CCA and the GEO Group have been major political players for the last decade. But it's very interesting to watch in cases like California where you're seeing sort of growing contract opportunities that it's kind of like clockwork. You'll just start to see the donations and the money on lobbying rising. This is certainly part of it. And I think, typically in California, I saw, this is not really a partisan thing. It's, they'll sort of donate to whoever is in power and whoever is sort of has the ability to make decisions on contracts or make decisions on important legislation.
What can you tell us?
Well, you know, in addition to campaign contributions, one of the things that we thought was really interesting was the scope of political connections that these companies have. You know, even given that there may be a small world of correctional executive talent, there's this revolving door between the industry and regulators that's really pretty breathtaking. Mm-hmm. And one of the examples that comes to mind is Harley Lappin, who used to head the Bureau of Prisons, the Federal Bureau of Prisons. He was arrested for drunk driving in January 2011. He resigned in March, and within a month to 2 months after that, he was hired by CCA as an executive. Cesar Condo was hired by Marco Rubio as his chief of staff, and within 90 days of that, the lobbying firm that Mr. Condo had co-founded was hired by GEO, and also at about that time, coincidentally or not coincidentally, Mr. Rubio was pushing legislation that, as part of immigration reform, would increase money for detention facilities, which, of course, GEO and CCA are most interested in.
And Pat, I mean, we mentioned that we invited both of these corporations to join the show, but they didn't call us back. They are publicly traded companies, right?
Yes, they are.
How transparent are they? I mean, what was it like to do the extensive reporting on this issue? Were you able to interview their executives?
Well, we had sent them very early on a list of questions that ranged, I think it was about 3 pages, very specific. And what we got in response were about 3 paragraphs from each of the companies, very generic paragraphs, and really did not address anything in any degree of specificity. But over and above that, what we found that was both fascinating and frustrating was the fact that so much of what GEO and CCA do in the state of Florida is considered a trade secret, up to including the salaries of their corrections officers and what kind of benefits the corrections officers get. In fact, there was an attorney for the state of Florida. There was a bid protest involving a private prison contract, and the attorney for the state of Florida requested that CCA turn over information ranging from essentially, you know, how much it was spending on prisoners in various areas. And CCA responded that not only was that an overly broad request, it was a trade secret. And they had no intention of turning that information over to the state about the running of its state prison.
Well, we've got time for just a few more calls. So let's hear from Maggie in Monterey. Hi, Maggie. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for having this discussion. You know, I think we've quickly become a nation of better, you know, built on better prisons. When you look at the way that the correctional facility industry or the Department of Corrections has been building so many prisons in the state of California, I can tell you that when Governor Brown ran for, well, when he was running for governor, he went around the state, and his one of his big pushes for getting in as governor was that he was going to be supporting education. He talked about the prison industry being a conveyor belt to itself to the prison industry because the inmates would get out and they would go back in. And I see him going in the opposite direction of what he was talking, going with these outsourced prisons, which have become, which is nothing but profiteering off the poor. We are incarcerating way too many people that are do not... one for drugs. We've got way too many incarcerated there. But, you know, I wanted to bring up, I heard you talk about the phone calls. You know, with phone calls in Arizona, they're paying as much as $23 for 15 minutes for families to talk to their loved ones. And I know that the FCC has been taking a look at this nationally. And I think in Virginia, they just made a change that won't take place until January, where some of those costs are going to be coming down. But, you know,
Maggie, let me just ask you, because we have just about a minute left. I understand that you were able to oppose a new prison in Salinas.
Yes.
How did you do that?
Oh, well, let me tell you, this is how I came across the people in CURB.
And we have about a minute, just a minute left.
A while back, they had they put a bill on that was AB 900, and it was an unfunded bill. and they set out to build about 13 facilities. And what they were going to do is they were going to put them in counties. They're going for Calipatria. Monterey County was one of them. And this was put together by sheriffs, local sheriffs who went up, and they figured this all out on their own. And unbeknownst to us, these things started going. In order for them to happen, they had to go through certain, like they had to go through the city council, to the county board of supervisors, and it was all hush-hush under the table. And somebody brought it to my attention because I'm an activist. And the way that I was able to shut it down was just to go directly to the source, which was not the Department of Corrections, who were coming and having meetings, following me everywhere, and other activists, but to go directly to the source, and that was our elected officials. We put so much pressure on our local elected officials during their election campaigns. I'm a Democrat. A lot of them were Democrats, and they were not too happy with me, but I don't serve elected officials. They serve people. And we here, and I was in contact with other people from CURB who told me they had been fighting them for months.
And Maggie, we're going to have to let you go because we're out of time, but thank you so much for calling in. Maggie wanted to share a story about fighting off a new prison in Salinas successfully. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We'll continue following this issue. Chris Kirkham is a reporter with the Huffington Post. Check out his piece about for-profit prisons are big winners of California's overcrowding crisis. Pat Beal published the report, Private Prisons, Profit Politics, Pain, for the Palm Beach Post. And Alex Friedman is managing editor of Prison Legal News. He spent 6 years in a private prison. And thank you all for joining us. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the parliamentary trial of Guardian Editor-in-Chief Alan Rusbridger. He's accused of helping terrorists by publicizing top-secret information leaked by Edward Snowden. We'll also discuss coverage of Syria. For the first time, the UN has accused President Bashar al-Assad of committing war crimes. We'll be joined by The Washington Post's Liz Sly and Free Press's Josh Stearns. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.